Okay, thank you all for joining us at our lunchtime conversation. It's the third of our series here for 2026 relating to the element of water, and I'm delighted to welcome Kajal Modi, designer and teaching fellow at Leeds University. And I had the privilege to supervise Kajal's PhD some years back at the University of the West of England, where her work looked at multi-species relations through the lens of invisible microbial food cultures, specifically looking at fermentation and what we will discuss as anti-knowledges, which is one of the most wonderful terms that Kachal has coined, among others, in relation to her work with Asian communities and the diaspora here in the UK. Kachal, welcome.
Thank you, Teresa. Thank you for having me. I mean, it's such a great series of events that you've organized, so I'm just really, really pleased to be invited and to be part of it.
Thank you. And I guess before we're here really to speak about your work, Songs of Water, which is about a particular project, a river project actually that you carried out in Leeds. And before we go into that, actually, I would like to sort of, I guess, expand a little bit on the work that you also did in relation to kitchen cultures, because one, I guess, of the key things that I see in your work, which is also manifested in Songs of Water, is this intergenerational work that you do. And of course, this was really also present in your PhD with this notion of anti-knowledge, but also around your work on fermentation and practices around becoming entangled with microbes, which again, are present in water in multiple forms. Can you share a little bit, first of all, about this entry into this microbial world and how it started for you?
I mean, I think, as you're very well aware, I am a very practice-led maker, researcher, thinker. So I tend to make first and then maybe articulate what it was I was trying to find out through the making afterwards, which means that sometimes I end up going in directions I didn't expect, or sometimes there's a framing that I'm definitely deliberately exploring that reveals things I didn't expect. And I feel like there's a metaphor there about the invisible, right? And the entanglements that we're already engaged with that are not visible until you go and look for them. And I think in a way, kitchen cultures was so much about the knowledge that lives in our communities that we're often overlooking. So for me, that is migrant communities. And for myself and my collaborator, Fatima Takelman, who is the chef I collaborated with, she's a very old friend. And she and I, sorry, I should say they prefer they now. They and I worked on this project as a way to sort of articulate this knowledge that we'd grown up with, which was about maximizing resources, what living sustainably and making the most of what you had. But it was also about the way that that was so intrinsically part of our cultures and our communities that it almost didn't need to be articulated. And through that, I guess, and I did suspect this, right? Because I was working with and looking at fermentation, and one of the things that I really, really noticed was that fermentation is so deeply embedded in our food cultures that it's also very difficult to draw out. And often there is something else. It's like Maya Hay says this, there's always something that's a proxy for the microbes. And to me, that is the relationship and the process and that emerges through fermentation. And there was something about that hidden relationship that there was a slippage into the spiritual. And I feel like sometimes, when you talk about what's happening, people will talk about things like, oh, it's breathing, oh, it's alive in some way, there's a vitality to the process, or it's I remember Fozia Ismail saying this thing about, when you're fermenting in Somali cultures, you'd say it's ready when many eyes are watching you, and that's what the bubbles signify. So there's something of a livingness, a lightness, or like Maya's own work, where she was working with sake brewers. They talk about these spirits or gods coming to visit, and that's what activates the ferment. And I feel like that aspect of the work didn't maybe start to imagine till I started working with water and thinking about the microorganisms that are present in water. But I feel like, you know, these are quite complex scientific and ecological practices that live in a kitchen that my aunties, our aunties, as we started to call them, were negotiating. And like, I think when I say auntie knowledge to people, most of them know what I mean. And particularly when they're from migrant communities, they go, oh yeah, of course, auntie knowledge. My auntie knows things. And so it was, and the Kitchen Cultures Project, as you know, was about the way that those different community knowledges intersected through the recipes that we were creating, because that was a project that was partly supported by the Eden Project's Invisible Worlds exhibition. And so that was another aspect of the invisibility that emerged. And yeah, there was something there that, like, I was exploring these complex relationships and ecologies in the kitchen, and then I was thinking about actually how do they live in the landscape? And that's where I took the step from the kitchen to the landscape, because there was also a part of it where it was like there's a particular way that I feel like the countryside and the outdoors is constructed in the UK that makes it inaccessible in various ways to a lot of people, including migrant communities. And there's lots written about this, and there's lots of people who have ideas about why this is the case, whether that's racism, whether that's the histories of colonialism that constructs these, you know, like quite manicured landscapes that people are not supposed to feel welcome in, or whether that's to do with just the fact that the weather is not as nice as what my family might have been used to growing up in like Africa and India. And so, you know, and they go, oh, why? Like, I always joke that it'd be like, you know, we never went camping when I was a child, because it's like, why would we sleep outside when we've got this perfectly good house? Whereas, you know, for, and this seems to be a really, really common thread again with all of my friends who are migrants, where you go, oh, yeah, these are really, really common experiences. So you go, okay, well, what are the spaces that we occupy that are outdoors? And often they're in urban places. And so, and I was really interested in the fact that the specific river that I ended up doing the Songs of the Water project with is like maybe a 5 to 10 minute walk from where I grew up. But we'd very rarely go and visit the river deliberately. Like, you know, you might encounter it if you were like, we're going for a walk today. But even then, it would be like a very, very deliberate, you know, we're going out as a group, as a community, or as a group of women, which was a thing that we used to do with the women's group that I ended up working, revisiting this idea with. And so, yeah, I think there was a thread there. And I remember I said to you very specifically about the fact that one of the things that happened over lockdown was that after my grandmother passed, we couldn't take her ashes to the Ganges, because my family are Hindu and that is something you would traditionally do. And so my family, and I couldn't go, but my family took a boat out into the middle of the River Soar and put her ashes into the river there. And I was just amazed by this. Like, I was watching the video and going, wow, is this okay? Does this feel, how do I feel about this? And in the midst of kind of interrogating how I felt about it, because I'm not particularly religious, I have, you know, I was raised within this culture. And I think for me, culture and religious practice, as for many people in the global south, are kind of inseparable. And so I asked my auntie, the same auntie that I'm sure you've heard loads about, Teresa, when we were doing the yogurt fermentation. I asked my auntie, like my dad's sister, who had come over to look after my grandmother as she was getting older, how she felt about the fact that she couldn't take the ashes back to India and inter them in the Ganges. And she was like, oh no, it's fine, it's all connected. And I was like, oh, this feels like something. I want to explore this a little bit further. Because if it's all connected, where does that connection happen? And as I started to explore it a little bit further with this group, I feel as though other things started to emerge. So, yeah, I don't know if that answered your question.
No, I think you created a wonderful bridge from, you know, PhD work that really happened as you referenced, but I just want to kind of foreground it in lockdown. And it was at this particular, you know, time where it was quite difficult to actually carry out some of the research that you were actually focusing on because, you know, the very act of meeting, of actually cooking together, of doing this kitchen culture work was not possible really because of lockdown, essentially. And the flexibility that you demonstrated as a practitioner and as a thinker then to sort of shift around that was really inspiring to also sort of see. But you referenced there also people's work like Maya's and Fozzie, and it would just be nice for those who may not know those people, because they also connect in a way directly and on the fringes of the elemental program. Can you just sort of give a little kind of reference to that work, because you're part of a much, I guess, wider group of practitioners who are looking at microbes as your sort of co-partners in creating work. And it's almost like I'm just creating a footnote in the conversation so that we can kind of go on really in a way to the deeper sense of where Songs of River took you, because some of the main things that you were, I guess, exploring within the PhD was this, as you say, very deeply, very entangled work in kitchen cultures that's present but not necessarily spoken about in any sort of elitist kind of way. So please share just the references to Maya and Fozzie and how and who they are and how your work is there, and then we'll skip to Songs of Water in more detail.
Yeah, for sure. So, Maya Hay is a researcher, a microbial researcher, based at the University of Helsinki in the Center for the Social Study of Microbes. And I met Maya during my PhD because she read something that I'd written about fermentation and got in touch and asked if I wanted to collaborate on this zine that she produces called Food Feminisms Fermentation, or maybe it's Food Fermentation Feminism, so I always get that the wrong way around, but it's FFF. And so it's a biannual publication, so they did one in 2025, so the next one will be coming up in 2027. And I contributed something for that, and then we stayed in touch. And then we met at a conference, and she said, why don't you apply for this fellowship in Helsinki? So I went and spent some time at CSSM and met some incredible microbial researchers there. In fact, I think I flew out the day after I submitted my PhD.
Yes. I
And
remember.
so, yeah, no, and like, it was a really, really interesting time to be there because there was a certain freedom I suddenly had to continue with the thinking of fermentation in this space with people, not all of whom ferment, which I don't know why I was surprised by that, but I was surprised by that. There were some events that happened which were like literally, oh, we'll share some fermentation skills, we'll share some starters. Fozia Ismail is part of a collective called the Khan Collective based in Bristol. And I know you've worked with Fozia before, Teresa. I encountered Fozia's work. I think actually, Teresa, you told me to go and look at it, and I did, and I was blown away because Fozia used to run this supper club. I don't know if she still does. She runs a supper club called Arawello Eats, which is with Somali women based in Bristol. And then she's also part of the Ghan Collective. And at the time, my friend Asma was doing some translation for the Ghan Collective. So the collective is Fozia Ismail and Ayan Kilmi, and a group of Somali elders that they work with. And I think one of the things I was really inspired by was that deep collaboration and connection that Fozia and Ayan have in community. And I think they were showing camel meat and tapes while lockdown was just starting, so I couldn't go and see it at the Arnolfini. And that was work that was about intergenerationality, about collective memory, about how taste and memory interrelate. And I had this conversation with Fozia about, like, how she maintains those collaborations and how she and it's a conversation we've continued to have, because funnily enough, when I was commissioned for Songs of the Water by Counterpoint Arts, it turns out that they'd actually decided to award it to, because it was supposed to be for one artist or one set of artists. It was supposed to be one commission, and actually they ended up awarding it to myself and to the Khan Collective. And at the time I didn't know this was the case, but then when I found out, I was like, of course I know the Khan Collective, and I'm just very honored to be included alongside them. So yeah, I feel like that's like a a conversation that's been ongoing as well. And and Teresa knows this, but like I feel like my work is always very collaborative. I do my best thinking and making in collaboration with others. And I sometimes see my role in those instances just to facilitate that thinking. And then the making emerges as a thread alongside that to also facilitate different aspects of the knowledge.
Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for making reference to those practitioners who I think also share that affinity in their work. So Songs of Water, I just, going back to the beautiful introduction that you made in connecting the work that you were doing in kitchen cultures and just kind of making this bridge now for those who might have joined a bit late to, as you say, from the kitchen to the land to the water. This spiritual element, in a way, and that reference point that you made to, your family and the burial practices in water as well. What was the shape of Songs of Water, and how, in a kind of practical sense, did it emerge? Because I'm really interested in the ways in which you get people to sort of listen, in a sense, and a lot of your work is, in a way, I would say, lo-fi entry into listening deeply. And you do this in a very gentle kind of way because you don't necessarily foreground yourself as a sort of a sound artist, but it is sound becomes a very critical kind of medium. So can you share a little bit about, what was the duration and the people and what came out then?
Yes, absolutely. I first want to just pick up on this the sound aspect of my practice, because this is something that emerged almost incidentally during my PhD, where some of my collaborators weren't comfortable with being photographed or having video of them made available. So I ended up making some illustrations, and I also then had all these collections of sounds, so voice notes, sounds of cooking, conversations that we'd had on Zoom, because a lot of it was happening on Zoom because it was during lockdown. And then I did a commission with an organization called Arts Catalyst, who are based in Sheffield, who do work around artistic practices, nature, technology, and that was specifically for people who maybe had an idea for a sound piece, specifically people from the global majority who maybe had an idea for a sound piece but had no experience in doing this. And through this, I met the sound designer Kitty Turner, who I continued to collaborate with as part of Songs of the Water. And alongside that, I think another thing that was happening was I was working as a research assistant at a bioarchitecture centre in Newcastle University. And there I met a couple of artists. And you described me as a designer, Teresa, and like I still feel very design in my soul, but I feel like my practice has become very artistic. And it was through another researcher who was based at the centre at the time called Louise McKenzie, who I then started to collaborate with and continue to collaborate with, who also has a water-based practice where she uses hydrophones to listen underwater, and an artist we commissioned called Michelle Allen, who did some listening at the confluence of the Tyne and the Teme. And I remember she brought some of that those recordings to a microbiologist called Angie Sherry, who was based in the research centre, to be like, is this anything? And I remember Angie going, "Oh, you hear those bubbles? Those are microorganisms." And I was like, "I want the bubbles. I want to hear the bubbles. I want the microorganisms to sing to me." So that was one part of it. And then there was the other part, which was the this idea of these waterways being connected. And so, unfortunately, by the time I started this project, by the time I was commissioned by Counterpoints Arts, by the producer, Deanna Rakovich, who is very, very heavily involved with running Refugee Week in London, my auntie, who'd said this thing about everything being connected, had moved back to India. And so I was like, okay, who do I want to talk to? And I was talking to my mum. And she was kind of saying, "Oh, you know, there's an Ashes internment point just up the road. Why don't we go and visit it when you next come here?" And then I was kind of saying, "Oh, I want to talk to and maybe you want to talk to some of your friends. And then she was like, oh, you know what, why don't we get why don't we get the band back together? Why don't we get the women's group back together? So the women's group was a group of women who my mum, when I was a child, my mum had run this women's group for women in the community who just wanted to come and learn new skills and like meet new people. There was some other stuff involved, but I'm not going to talk about that here. And through that, like I made loads of friends through that group because it wasn't just the women, it was of course also their children. I ended up babysitting the little ones and, you know, going like I remember re like reconnecting with a couple of them at sixth form, and I got really tearful because it was like, oh wow, these were really like formative memories, like us spending summers together and doing all these activities together. So yeah, we organized a couple of, well, first of all, most important part of the practice, mum put together a WhatsApp group. Now, again, as Teresa knows, WhatsApp is such a big part of my practice, and I never intended for it to be, but it's because I think when you're from a migrant community, WhatsApp was one of the first ways you could send voice over IP for free, and it's very accessible. So all of my aunties, in the blood relations and otherwise, use WhatsApp. And so my mum put together this WhatsApp group, and we just started chatting about this project. And I was like, oh, would you be interested? And they were all really up for meeting up on the riverside. And, you know, of course, everyone brought snacks. So we did this a couple of times. And the first time it was just a picnic. And the second time, we started to, I recorded some of it, and I asked them if they wanted to engage in this listening practice. And the listening practice was, I was sort of speaking to Louise about this, and she was like, okay, well, here's what you need to do. You need to go and speak to Jez Riley French. So, and look up Leah Barclay's work. So Leah Barclay is a sound artist based in Australia who does amazing work with communities on listening underwater as a way to furnish communities who live by waterways that maybe are dealing with pollution to in some ways, like create these kind of living labs that allow them to like monitor for certain organisms, certain species, and biodiversity and pollution. And so I was like, okay, this sounds like a really nice way in. But I couldn't see my aunties, and also they just didn't seem as interested in this. Also, a lot of them are older now and not as mobile, doing some of the more involved scientific work. So I was like, well, why don't I involve some young people? And again, the intergenerational sharing emerges. And so I was put in touch with an organization called Soft Touch Arts, who are an arts charity based in the center of Leicester, who work with young people who are out of education, out of employment, or who've been excluded from school. So they cover quite a wide range of ages. And they have a lot of music projects, they have a lot of visual art projects, and at the time they were doing lots of work around waterway pollution. So they were really interested in this. So I ran a summer school. Now, one of the things I really wanted to do was to make our own hydrophones, because this is something that Leah Barclay does, and she talks about how this becomes again a site of agency to, like, you know, have ownership over your tools. And I feel like there's something really nice about the DIY aspect of this. But we didn't really have the time. I had like a week to run a summer school. I think it ended up being like actually full on 2 days, and the rest of the time was just us doing stuff in the studio. So I bought some hydrophones from Jez Riley French, and they're very, very simple contact mics covered in rubber that are just weighted enough that they can be placed underwater with really long wires. And I got Kitty to come out and do some, you know, the technical side, because I'm now learning the technical side just through doing these projects. But at the time, I wasn't massively knowledgeable about how these technologies work. So we went out and we did some. On the first day, we spent some time with the Canal and River Trust, and they walked us down the Rivesaw and Grand Union Canal and talked a bit about the history of the place. And what was really interesting was they were talking about how the canal specifically had been shaped, but actually the river too, because they were shaped side by side, had been shaped by industrialization. And the way that that was so much to do with the textile trade. And I think You know this, but the next bit that I found really, really interesting that emerged was that my family had actually grown cotton on their farm in India. And so there's this part of me that wants to go and do some research in the archive to see if any of that cotton actually made it to Leicester, because there's something about the fact that my family or migrant communities have shaped these waterways before we were even here that I think became really central to the project. But yes, so the listening. So we had two sets. Everyone had a recorder and two sets of two hydrophones, so that we could listen in stereo. So what I asked the young people to do was to we did a we did a we did the day with the Canal and River Trust, where they told us about the river, and we also did some litter picking. So they were just like, that's an activity we do with young people. And then we took some of that rubbish, not all of it, because some of it we couldn't use, but we used it. At Soft Touch Arts to make prosthetics to listen underwater. And some of these were just so good. They were so interesting. They were really tentacular. And then the next day we went out and did some recording. And these recordings then got turned into like a sample library by Kitty for the young people to use as part of their music making practice.
Thank you. I mean, it's such a generous project, Kajal. I think, like, it always strikes me when this work, which sometimes gets, under this very broad label as social practice or, working with communities, never is it's there's never justice done if you go to somebody's website or even if you, read a paper and explain in details, because there's so many, like, call it tentacles or heads or versions that kind of like manifest in so many different ways. Where are you now with the work, and where is that sort of developing in terms of the listening to water practices? And you mentioned thinking about, whether this kind of cotton came. Are you in a position at the moment to look at that, or where is it?
No, not at the moment. I think it's kind of been parked for a little while, but I would love to revisit it. I think I started this new role at Leeds and then the teaching took over and there hasn't really been room to revisit it. But the aim is to revisit it, is to visit some of the archives as well, to look at, some of the histories of import of textiles that were then shaping the river, and to go back and work with some of these young people again. Because actually lots of them, that it's changed now. They work with some of the young people they work with for such a long period of time, and some of them it's much shorter. As soon as they get back into education, they go, okay, no, you're good. We can support you for part of this, but they have the funding and the capacity that they have. So, but it would be really nice to be able to go and run something again.
Thank you. And we're hoping that you will come to Kubu in October, because the River Collective, which will be showing at that time and opening their show on the 12th of October and closing it on, sorry, 12th of September and closing on the 25th of October, coincides with the period that you will be also in Helsinki. But I was also just thinking about your work in bubbles really fits our theme for air next year. So I hope we can continue the kind of conversation. We're kind of slightly coming to the close of our sort of lunchtime sessions, but one thing I really wanted to kind of return to, because you have in a way very fluidly, shared how the Songs of Water came about, the people that were involved in it, the way that you worked with listening practices and the development of the hydrophones. But it's to sort of circle back to the wider theoretical frameworks that sort of guide your work, which is this notion of kind of becoming with others. And you have, again, wonderful terms that you use to explain this. And where are you with that thinking now? And can you sort of share how this has, I guess, connects your work? Because entanglement, becoming with the kind of microbial, this processes of listening in a way are very, I would say, tying into the heart of the matter, in a sense, that you're working to.
I think this is still something I'm working through at the moment, but I'm very much looking forward to. So we've got a I'm going to do a little plug. So we've got a show coming up at the BioArt Society for CSSM, where myself and five other artists will be showing work around the microbial and the human relationship with the microbial. And I think one of the things I'm really interested in is, there's this push to, Rob McFarlane wrote about, is a river alive? There's a push to grant legal rights and personhood to rivers. And I worry about what that means for the communities who live with those rivers, when actually somehow they become more person than a lot of people who are really, really dehumanized who live alongside them. And I think a lot of the legislation around this is shaped by this, but I think sometimes when you take this out of its context, it becomes more about that colonial man nature, Cartesian dualism of like, it's nature, it's pristine, it's better when it's untouched. But actually, these are ecosystems that we live with and we live alongside and we are part of. And I think that more than humanness, I think sometimes the human gets left out of that. And I think the human is absolutely a really, really big part of that, partly just through the way that we are thinking and working with, but also in the theoretical. So I think that's where the becoming with happens for me. Yeah. But
Yeah, thank you so much. No,
yes. No worries. You
I
ask good
know that it's I
questions.
know it's an ongoing part of work of all of our work in a sense. And I think in the last couple of years, where the more than human has become such a sort of a dominant narrative in post-human thinking, and also the elemental turn in a way is a further sort of exploration of that, that these kind of questions of like law and legality and personhood and property are really like challenging narratives in a sense. And this rights to nature has sort of dominated in some ha has become a trend, and it's not the answer to all of it. And I think what you said is very pertinent to the kind of critiques of that. So thank you. And I know that this is ongoing work, and it's not about trying to have all of the solutions right now. Kajal, it's been wonderful to talk to you about Songs of Water, and thank you for sharing your time, and thanks for everyone for tuning in.
Well,
We
thank
look
you.
forward to receiving you in Kubu, we hope in October, and to carrying on conversations with you regarding air and bubbles. I'm going to give a little plug and drop it into the chat that the next session that we will have is Margarita Mendes. The time there has come out in white, but it's on the 25th of June. Margarita Mendes is a Portuguese curator who has recently published a co-edited volume of works, The Word for World is Water. Of course, a nod there to Le Guin. World Building and Creative Resistance Through Liquid Alliances. Margarita is well known for her work in the Anthropocene, so I'm sure that some of you might recognize her work. And a little shout out, because I know that we have Leah here and Kathy, who are both very much tuning into your work, because they would probably like to follow up in conversations regarding your listening practices with rivers and water, which of course is part of their shares. Yeah, looking forward to tuning in for the next session. And thanks again to Kubu and to Tumo for hosting. And Kajal, see you soon, I hope. Bye bye, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Teresa. Thank you, Tuomo.
Bye.
Bye
Thank
bye.
you very much. Bye bye.